Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Take Aim, Accuracy in Media's weekly talk show on Blog Talk Radio. AIM is America's original media watchdog, celebrating our 40th anniversary this year, and every week we point out biased coverage and bring you the stories the mainstream media ignore. We encourage you to visit our website at aim.org and sign up to receive our daily email so you can keep track of what the media are up to. Let's see, I'm Roger Aronoff, a media analyst with AIM, joined today by my co-host, Don Irvine. Don, how are you today?
Fine. How are you, Roger?
Doing great, thanks. So it looks like we've got another really good show today. First up, we have Anita Moncrief, who is a whistleblower who previously worked for AIM, and I mean for Acorn, and she found things going on there that she really didn't like and came out and has become a remarkable whistleblower. And later we have Bob Dane of FAIR, the Federation for American Immigration Reform. So let's see if we have Anita on the line and we can get right into this. Anita, are you there?
I'm here.
Great. Well, this is Roger and Don, and we're so pleased to have you on the show today.
I'm pleased to be here. Thanks for having me.
Great. Well, Anita, as I said, worked for ACORN, the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now, and then became a whistleblower. ACORN is the controversial community activist group with ties to President Obama. They've received a lot of federal money and recently a lot of scrutiny, mainly in the conservative media and Congress, though not much in the mainstream media. Tell us about you, Anita, how and why you went to work for ACORN originally.
Well, I was in Alabama in 2005, and I was working with another company, and I had an opportunity to come back to D.C. for a promotion and higher money. But at the same time, I was looking for things that were more in the social justice realm. I wanted to really help people. I felt like my life wouldn't mean anything if I was just collecting a paycheck. I wanted to do something. So I interviewed with ACORN. At the time, I'd never heard of Project Vote. They never mentioned anything but ACORN through the interview, but they told me all the great things they did to help people and how they were really working hands-on in the community. So I turned down the other job offer, and I took a lower pay to go come to D.C. and work with ACORN. When I got there, I realized that I was actually getting paid from Project Vote, but I was working on a lot of ACORN political stuff, and I got to see some really interesting things. I started working on voter fraud research, which was some of the accusations from the 2004 elections. And one pattern that seemed to start emerging the whole way that I was doing the research was that it was always blamed on one lone employee. That employee was vilified and made to seem to be the worst employee ever, and nothing ever came back to the organization. I saw this in case after case, and I started to wonder what was really going on. But it wasn't until 2006 that I started handling the money. After our national director left, they put me in charge of handling the grants and making sure that all of the funder database was updated with the information. That's where the really interesting stuff came in, because I started to realize that, in my opinion, the money that was coming in for Project Vote wasn't really going to Project Vote. It was going into the ACORN CCI and then being dispersed out as needed. I started raising questions with the management about certain things, and I even contacted a group, the Employment Policies Institute, in 2007, and I tried to come forward then, but they told me that things would get really bad and I might want to find another job before I went down that road.
So what was the purpose of Project Vote? What were they out to do, and what made you suspicious?
Because they're supposedly a nonpartisan voter registration organization that is totally separate from ACORN. But in my experience while I was working there, ACORN and Project Vote were basically the same thing. I was considered to be part of the national staff of ACORN political operations. A lot of the considerations that were made as to where they were going to do the voter registration drives were not only based on census information, but based on whether or not it was in a congressional district that they wanted to win. So ACORN was making the partisan decisions. Project Vote was running the nonpartisan voter registration drive, but they were using ACORN to do it. ACORN actively supported Democrat candidates, and they even made up flyers and door hangers, which they went out and put on people's doors saying, don't vote for this candidate, they have ties to Bush, or things like that. So it was strictly partisan in nature the whole time that I was there.
Okay, so... So then what did you do when you were beginning to have these doubts and these questions about what they were doing? What was your next step?
Well, after Rod and ACORN told me that they would feel more comfortable helping me if I wasn't still employed there, I decided I was going to try to reform ACORN from the inside. I contacted my supervisor, who at the time was Nathan Henderson James of ACORN Political Operations, and I told him about some of my concerns with the way employees were being trained for these voter registration drives and also the way African Americans were being treated on the staff. I had already filed an EEOC complaint at the same time that I had contacted Rod and ACORN, but I decided that I still believed in the mission. I could still do this from the inside. So I came up with a diversity plan, and also I talked to Zach Paulette, who was the executive director of Project Vote, and he was also over ACORN Political Operations, about some of my concerns with training. Zach told me that they were actually going to implement a new training model for the employees, and they were aware that there was a sink or swim mentality within ACORN. I presented my diversity plan in order to get more African Americans on staff into positions of power because it seemed to be very concentrated at the top. The same people that had been there for 25 years were still running things, but they were working within African American communities, but they were not letting these people in real positions of power. We always joked that Maude Heard was just a figurehead because she was a black woman, so they liked to put her out there in front anytime something happened. So that's what I was doing mostly, was trying to work from the inside, thinking that if you bring these issues to management, they will address them. Another issue I brought to them was the fact that they never organized in middle-income communities, like the middle class. They totally ignored these people. They always wanted things to be a poor black issue. And I told them that by making things only poor and black, I'm pretty sure that there are middle-income people that are concerned about minimum wage, too. But they didn't want to open it up to that class of people, and I suspect it's because they ask a lot of questions, and it would be harder to operate if they opened it up to people that might not go along with being told to come out and protest in front of someone's home.
Anita, this is Don Irvine.
Hi.
Good to hear from you. Hey, you know, we at AIM, in particular, Bethany Stotts, one of our correspondents here, were involved in a very public controversy with the New York Times' Stephanie Strom. What was your experience in dealing with the Times and, in particular, Ms. Strom?
Well, I contacted Stephanie Strom in 2008 in July, right after she wrote about the embezzlement scandal. We became... I want to say friends because we actually worked together on the ACORN story. It just wasn't me feeding her information. She would send me emails about things that she was looking into or ask me to contact other whistleblowers for her. Her story started, she seemed to be hot on the trail of a really big story, and she realized that this could be huge. But over time, her story started to appear to be watered down, and she would tell me things like, it's an election season, they only gave me a certain amount of space, or I'm going to get that into the next piece. But there were a couple of stories that were totally killed, and that's when I started to realize I couldn't trust her. I had given her the Obama second quarter donor list. This wasn't the donor list that he filed with the FEC. This was the complete list. This included the smaller donors that weren't turned over, maxed out donors, and donors who had had their payments returned back to the campaign if their credit card had maxed out or whatever. This was the complete list. Acorn was using it to raise money for voter registration, and there was also evidence of a meeting between the campaign and Acorn. I told her how I had taken a call from the Obama campaign asking me if this was the same Project Vote that Obama had worked with in the 90s, and I said yes, and I passed it on to my senior staff, my senior management staff. And then after that, all of a sudden, we had a donor list. She had this information. She was coming to Washington, D.C. to get more evidence when her editors told her to stand down from the story. She left that as a voicemail. I called her back, and she told me that it was the Times policy not to print anything that close to the election that may be considered a game changer.
So what was the relationship between then-candidate Obama and Acorn?
Apparently, they, from what I understand, they were working closely together, not only on damage control when they felt that, I think it was Palin that had maligned community organizers. So they were working together on damage control, from what I understand, and also with this donor list. As you know, President Obama worked with Project Vote in the 90s, and I was at a meeting where Zach Paulette got up in front of everyone in November of 2007 and said that he had personally supervised Barack Obama, and Acorn produces leaders.
Well, Anita, you made quite a shocking claim there, and I know that Stephanie Strom said that they don't publish anything that's a game changer that close to an election. What did you think when she told you that?
I was very upset because I had worked with her for months, and she could have broken the story in August or September. I had contacted independent columnist Mike Gaynor and Michelle Malkin right around the time I started to realize that Stephanie Strom was leading me on and just trying to keep me, you know, to get as close to the election as possible and then cut bait, as Clark Hoyt said. So I decided to testify in a court case that was going on in Pennsylvania at the time because I wanted the story to come out. I still voted for Obama, and at the time I was still a very hardcore liberal, but I told people that I don't think that if my team is cheating, then it's not really winning.
So tell us about the another affiliated group besides Project Vote was Citizen Services, and as I understand it, Obama campaign paid something like $800,000 to them to get out the vote, and they kind of didn't really tell the truth about what the money was to be used for. Is that right? Or tell us about that.
Correct. It was around $880,000 that they paid to CSI. And CSI was the business arm of Acorn. From information that I've been told by several people, apparently a lot of candidates use CSI in order to utilize Acorn's network of voter list, door knocking, and they have what they call a precinct action network, where they go around and they get people in their communities and they tell them, okay, we need you to turn out five votes. We need you to get five of your neighbors to come out and vote for a certain candidate. So they had a strategic plan for getting Democrats elected, and CSI was apparently one of the ways for them to do that, and the candidates were paying them for these types of services. At the same time, they were also running this nonpartisan voter registration drive.
Okay.
Well, Anita, you know, you mentioned about how you were a hardcore Democrat and had voted for Obama. I mean, how has this experience changed you politically?
Even after I voted for Obama, I had hope. And that's funny because, you know, he wrote in on hope. But I really thought that he was going to bring in transparency into the government. I thought that he would get into office and he would not let Acorn or SEIU have a say in the way things were going. What really turned me, I was already starting to turn a little, but what really turned me is in January of this year when I saw some of the people that he was selecting for cabinet positions. Being on the inside of two liberal organizations, that were union affiliated, I was aware that Kathleen Sebelius was very heavily connected to SEIU, and that Hilda Solis was basically used to was trying to push card check with another organization where she was the treasurer. This union affiliate organization had strong ties to Andy Stern, so I began to see a pattern of paybacks, most of them either leading back to ACORN, but mostly the SEIU. That's when I realized that this was a total sham. There was no hope or change, and if there was change, it wasn't the type of change that America really needed. So that's when I started to kind of shift to the right. And I tell people I'm not a Republican. I'm more of a little C conservative, which means I'm still learning, but I believe in the principles of the founding fathers and some of the things that I feel that liberals have thrown to the wayside. And so I can't honest and good conscience support a party that I feel is totally and thoroughly corrupt.
Now, you've also had your experience with the media and the New York Times. What has this experience done about any skepticism you may now have about the media?
Well, I was very idealistic. I really thought that the New York Times would report this story because it was – you know, they had enough facts. They had more facts for this story than they had for the one they ran on John McCain and his alleged affair. But I decided that if I was going to get the story out, I couldn't rely on the liberal media. That's when I started blogging and Twittering and working with other bloggers and trying to just get the story out. It started small scale, but as you see, it's finally built up to a roar. Thanks to Hannah and James, who did their prostitution sting videos. I feel like people are really starting to pay attention. But if we had just relied on mainstream media, this story would have gone nowhere, and it would have died out back in November of 08.
Well, you just mentioned that. That gets to my next question here about this this videotaping by O'Keefe, you know, at these ACORN offices, where he was posing as a pimp along with Hannah as a woman who was a prostitute. And the ACORN people who gave them advice on how to break all sorts of laws. What do you think about that entire story? I mean, you just kind of mentioned a little bit briefly.
Excuse me. I was shocked at first, not shocked that it happened, but I was really shocked at the response from the ACORN people. I think that their motives were pure and that it was genius. I really think that it was genius because it took ACORN and it put it in the home of the average American. The story is very complicated. It's not something you can tell in sound bites or in 5-minute segments on TV. It really takes a lot to get into it, but now America is paying attention. And I've seen some corrupt activity when I've been in these offices, and I've seen some really good people. There's a mix. You have your people that are idealistic and that are really just trying to help. And then you have people that have been there so long or have gotten used to what Michelle Malkin calls a culture of corruption that it becomes easier to do these types of things. Their actions were reprehensible in those videos, but I'm not surprised given some of the things that I saw happen in the ACORN offices.
Well, as a result of the videotapes and all the publicity, which mostly was on Fox News and on talk radio where you heard about it, Congress ended up cutting off funds to ACORN. But we heard this week from Senator Vitter's office in Louisiana that that they still are getting taxpayer dollars. Do you think they should be? And what sort of ways are they still getting money? Do you know anything about that?
Now, I know a little bit about that, and I don't think they should be receiving federal funds. They also have to realize that ACORN is made up of a number of entities. From what I understand from Representative Issa's report, there's over 300 entities. So there's money coming in for ACORN housing. Project Vote was receiving grants from the Election Assistance Commission. There are different ways that ACORN is receiving money, but it still doesn't make up the bulk of the money that goes into this this Council of Organizations, that's what they called it. So we also have to look at the funders, and some of these funders need to be held responsible because they're receiving tax credits for giving money to organizations like ACORN. Bank of America was giving money to them. They finally cut ties, but Citigroup hasn't. So it's not just defunding ACORN on a government level. It's also holding these nonprofits and foundations accountable for where their grant money is going. If they're aware of some type of illegal activity, then they should not be funding it.
this week there was a press conference at the National Press Club, and the chairman of ACORN, Bertha Lewis, was there and trying to address some of these scandals that you're talking about. And you mentioned the embezzlement earlier, but we didn't really get into that. She was asked about whether the amount of money embezzled by the founder, Dale Rathke, was $1 million or, as a Los Angeles prosecutor alleged on Monday, in excess of $5 million. She apparently claimed it was closer to the $1 million. What do you think? Was this $5 million figure made up, or what do you think is going on here?
Now, I'm not sure. I did hear that number from former board members that that told me this at the time, back in 2008, that the number was closer to $5 million. I talked to Stephanie Strong at the New York Times about it, and she said she had also heard it from a number of sources, though it was never reported on in the Times. So it's kind of debatable at this point, but I do think it was more than $1 million. The actual number, I think, will come out once they start looking at the books and doing a full forensic audit.
Well, what I thought was interesting, I attended that press conference that Bertha Lewis held, was just in terms of how blameless she tried to appear for herself and for ACORN, that, yes, there were problems, but, you know, it's really the previous administration that was largely responsible for it. You know, we talked about the funding cutoff. She said that, you know, that would be unconstitutional. You know, I think you may have seen that video clip that I had posted about how she talked about the foreclosure crisis, that if we had just followed ACORN's example, probably wouldn't have been in this foreclosure crisis. You know, what's your take on Bertha?
Bertha is very hilarious sometimes, I will say that. I have written several blog postings about ACORN's possible involvement in the financial crisis, including getting banks to lower their standards in order to comply with the Community Reinvestment Act. They protested in front of a number of banks back in the 90s and finally ended up partnering with Bank of America. Bank of America went into this partnership right before they were to acquire Fleet Boston, and ACORN had been giving them trouble. Other banks, they also harassed, such as Household Finance and Countrywide, ended up collapsing as the housing crisis started to come to a head, and they were absorbed by Bank of America. One company that they never touched, though, was World Savings, which is owned by Herb and Marion Sandler. They sold it to Wachovia right before the collapse and made $2.4 billion off of it. So there are some that say ACORN had a hand in the housing crisis, and now they're receiving money to help fix a problem that started with lowered standards.
You know, one of the other things she said, too, at the press conference that struck me, and I'd like to have your reaction to this, is just that how they were reporting, you know, the employees that had been responsible for voter fraud, voter registration fraud, things like that, and it was really the government that was slow to prosecute. What's your opinion about that?
That has always been a standard defense for ACORN, is that they will flag cards and send them in. In some cases, that is true, and in other cases, because of the way from what I saw, because of the way these employees were trained and how the offices were allowed to run independently, I think that it allowed for fraud to happen because they were more concerned about getting money than they were about the voter registration cards. One former board member called it funder fraud because she said that they were getting money up front to register 1.4 million or 1.3 million voters. And if 40% of those cards were fraudulent, they had already been paid for.
So with all this voter registration fraud, there have been convictions and they're under investigation in several states. Do you consider ACORN a threat to the integrity of our election process?
Yes, I do consider them to be a threat. That's one of the reasons why I came forward. It wasn't because I didn't want Obama to win at the time. It's just because I really felt that they were cheating and that it wasn't right and that there were too many people that had came out to work for ACORN that ended up in jail because of some things that I feel were allowed to happen in the offices. But those employees were thrown under the bus, and they were allowed to take the blame for something that maybe the organization should have been scrutinized, because this isn't the first time. There are allegations that go all the way back to 2000.
What needs to be done to undo the damage that they've done to the electoral system? In other words, the people who were registered and continue to be by them. I mean, this is something that's really horrifying to people who want honest and transparent and free and fair elections.
I think that one thing we need to do is to take race off of the table. Anytime that people try to do things like enact voter ID laws, everyone wants to say, oh, you don't want black people to vote. Black people don't have IDs. This is all about racism. And ACORN has used that defense very effectively. I really think that people need to start realizing that if you have to have an ID to cash a check, you should have to have an ID to vote. And that will stamp down on a lot of that right there. Also, I think that people need to pay more attention to absentee and provisional ballots, which is something that ACORN has studied extensively. I even helped them with a provisional ballot survey where we contacted election offices across the country to find out how they handle these ballots.
I noticed this morning on Facebook you had a post about being attacked, I think it was, by ACORN 8. Can you explain that to me a little bit?
Well, I try not to get into fighting with other whistleblowers, but I will say that the ACORN 8 has been exposing ACORN, but they want to do it internally. They feel like this was an internal scandal where I have come out against Democrats and Obama, so we ended up parting ways. I had always been a friend with Marcel Reed from the time that I worked in the D.C. office, and I was aware of her. I always felt like we had a great relationship, and after I came out, I felt like that relationship deepened. But as time has gone on, it seems like political differences have led us to where we are now. I still think that they're doing a great job exposing ACORN, but I think that it's more of a Democrat scandal than people want to let on, and that it does lead all the way to the White House, and that is something that I'm willing to say and put out there, but some people do not like that.
What kind of pressure and criticism have you faced from people who were previously your friends but who are upset with you for being a whistleblower? Have you been threatened in any way?
I haven't really been threatened. It's just the same things. And I'll tell your listeners this because I want people to know this. Some people will say that because I was fired from Project Vote for using a company credit card for personal experiences that I am not a real whistleblower and that I haven't gone through anything that whistleblowers go through when they expose things. I've also been called an opportunist, and people say that I really am not. I'm only on the right because the left won't have me, which is not true because I actually won't have the left. I don't want them anymore. After what happened with Obama, I think that a lot of Americans are starting to realize that being liberal is not what it used to be.
And one of my concerns after this videotaping the prostitution issue that came up, and then they fired a few people, is that people are going to think, oh, well, look, ACORN has been cleaned up. We don't really have to worry about them anymore. And the really insidious problem with them is destroying the integrity of our electoral system. And so I'm concerned that, once this scandal blows over, that, we're going to kind of start looking the other way again. Do you share that concern?
I had that concern at first, but I've seen a lot of things that have gone up at BitGovernment.com where Andrew Breitbart is trying to make sure that people understand that there is a lot of different aspects to the ACORN issue. And it's great because since his site released the videos, people are going there for this ACORN information, and they're starting to realize this goes a lot deeper than just prostitution scandals and a little bit of voter fraud, as they like to call it. This goes all the way to what's going on in the communities and how ACORN is trying to have a position, a hold in the White House. And it's not just Gaspard or Obama. It's several ACORN connections, such as John Podesta and Andy Stern and a lot of people that have the president's ear. That's the dangerous part right there.
Okay. And what now for you? What are your plans to continue on in this mode, or what do you what do you see in your near future?
Well, I know that I'm going to continue exposing Acorn, even though they've got a $5 million lawsuit against me right now. I'm just going to keep speaking about it because every time I meet someone that hasn't heard the whole Acorn story, it shocks me and it makes me realize that I have got to keep speaking out, even if people are trying to make me become silent or scared.
Okay. And one final thing, is there anything we've left out that you would, any final point you would like to make before we sign off with you?
I would just like to tell people that to please contact their state attorney general's office, because a congressional investigation is great, but we don't need a report issued with recommendations. We need a full Department of Justice investigation of Acorn and its affiliates.
Okay. And how can people get to your blog and follow what you're doing, and Twitter or whatever, if people want to continue to follow you, Anita?
My blog is anitamoncrief.blogspot.com, and I'm on Twitter at Anita Moncrief, all one word.
Great. Well, thank you. You've been a great guest. We really appreciate your all that you've done and the courage and principle you have shown, and keep it up. And thank you so much for being a guest.
You're welcome, and thanks for having me.
You bet. Okay, folks, we are going to get right into our next guest. Let's see, we've got Bob Dane. Bob is with FAIR. Are you on the line there, Bob?
I am, sir, and it's good to be with you. Thank you.
Great. This is Roger Aronoff and Don Irvine, and we welcome you to Take AIM.
Hi, Roger. Hi, Don.
Bob joined FAIR, which is the acronym for Federation for American Immigration Reform, in 2006, after 20 years in the radio broadcast industry, mostly with Westwood One, CBS Radio Networks. He worked in management, marketing, and on the air. And prior to that, he worked for the Reagan administration, and he is currently the press secretary and communications director for FAIR. Tell us about you, Bob. How did you come to work for FAIR?
Well, you know, I have always had... One of the reasons I liked FAIR is because FAIR, Federation for American Immigration Reform, has no party affiliation or loyalty to a special interest. And I think that gives us a lot of freedom, a lot of latitude to talk to both the left and the right and the middle. Because, frankly, we've got a meltdown. We've got an immediate and a long-standing crisis in immigration. It is not a black or white or brown issue. It's not a left or a right issue, a Republican or a Democratic issue, liberal or conservative. It's a right and a wrong issue. This organization leads the Immigration Reform Group. We've got over 250,000 members nationwide. And I think what we do best is we take a look at what immigration policy is designed to do, what it has always been designed to do throughout history, and what every country has a right to do, and that is to take a look at the policy and see how it serves the broad national interest, improving the economy, protecting jobs, for me personally, protecting the environment, controlling population. You can't get a handle on that unless you have some sensible limitations on immigration. And certainly post 9/11, establishing a rule of law that's recognized and enforced and enhances our national security.
And how does FAIR go about pursuing these goals?
Well, there's several arms of FAIR. We have activists in all 50 states and groups. We help local citizens organize locally to deal with immigration in their backyard, in their communities, their counties, and their state. We have a very reputable, long-standing government relations office. We assist in crafting bills, assisting lawmakers who are working diligently on behalf of the American public for sensible immigration reform. And we talk to millions of Americans each week. Not surprisingly, talk radio has become one of the allies. This venerable electronic town hall of talk radio has really gotten the message out. And, you know, I think it was a feather in talk radio's cap, and perhaps FAIR's, that back in 2007, due to the outcry over the McCain-Kennedy-Bush amnesty bill, talk radio listeners literally melted down the Capitol switchboard, and what would have been amnesty for 12 million illegal aliens wound up going on the junk heap.
I sure did. Give us a little thumbnail history lesson about the growth of legal immigration in this country. How has it evolved over the last century or so?
Well, look, you know, for a long time, for most of the 20th century, we went through what most people would consider the golden age of immigration. We had wide open spaces. We had cities to populate, factories to build. We needed the manpower. We needed sheer numbers of human beings to build the infrastructure, to build the American fabric into a robust enterprise. And it was a golden age of immigration because those who came here wanted to come here. They assimilated. We needed those folks. They came here with real skills, real aptitude, and a true love and an interest in the American way. We also had periods where when it was deemed inappropriate to allow more folks in, the government intervened and we had cooling off periods. And we had some sensible limitations. But in 1965, Senator Kennedy really made some very dramatic changes to the immigration laws, and he reduced the skilled workers from developed nations that helped build the U.S. and increased unskilled immigrants from the third world. I mean, his bill basically cut the number of European immigrants in half and increased third world immigrants to 85% of the total. So, you know, that change was really an extension to our immigration policy, the civil rights battle that was occurring at the time. And even though perhaps we could say it was well-intentioned, the fact is that today's immigrants are a much different profile than previous immigrants. 69% have no reported profession, occupation, or job with an average ninth grade education. You have to ask yourself these days, with 1.2 million legal immigrants coming into the country with inadequate skills in our high-tech society, how that serves our broad national purpose.
Bob, by your count then, how many illegal immigrants are there in the country now, and how do we really know?
Well, just a tad less than we had last year. We've got about 11.6 million illegal immigrants in the United States. It's down from an all-time high of 12 million. Why? Really two reasons. One is increased enforcement at the border, interior enforcement, E-Verify. And also, it is a function, clearly, of the economy. Jobs are the reason illegal aliens come. It is the reason they stay. So clearly, the downturn in the economy has created less of a jobs magnet. But make no mistake, in the latter half of the Bush administration, we got tough on enforcement. We put up more of the wall. We implemented E-Verify. We had 287G agreements. And we were apprehending and deporting record numbers of illegal crossers. So right now, those 12 million illegal, the 11.6 million illegal aliens in the United States right now are really costing U.S. taxpayers billions of dollars, $57 billion annually to subsidize illegal immigration in three areas, incarceration, healthcare, and education, although education is overwhelmingly the largest portion. So as I've often said, $57 billion annually to subsidize illegal immigration, does cheap labor still sound like a bargain?
Well, I mean, how do we track that, though?
Well, you track it by the numbers of foreign-born minus the number of exits out of the country. We keep close tabs on this, and FAIR's numbers of 11.6. Now, the numbers are all over the place, and we tend to have always erred on the side of being very cautious. There are those who claim that there are 20 and 30 million illegal aliens in the country. We tend to have a figure that's a little more conservative, one that's that we're able to quantify and document. But if 11.6 million does not give you pause for concern, then 20 million certainly won't.
Now, FAIR has just come out with a pamphlet called A Guide to Understanding the Tactics of the Southern Poverty Law Center in the Immigration Debate. Who is the Southern Poverty Law Center, and what's the purpose of this pamphlet?
Well, understand that the Southern Poverty Law Center is not an immigration policy group. I think it is fair to say that the Southern Poverty Law Center was an asset when they first started back in 1971. They had social justice, poverty issues, racial discrimination issues at the heart of their mission. Their crowning achievement in their early history was really a lawsuit that broke the back of that despicable group, the KKK. Since that time, they have encountered, they faced what so many groups have, mission creep, where they struggle to really define who they are, what type of cases they want to work on. And in recent years, particularly since the 2007 Senate amnesty bill defeat, they've latched on, they've capitalized on the immigration debate. Now, again, they have the Southern Poverty Law Center, run by Morris Dees out of Montgomery, Alabama, has no self-avowed position on the issue of immigration. Yet they're interjecting themselves into this debate, and they're engaged in this political retaliation, trying to discredit Americans and large mainstream groups like FAIR, who want the nation's immigration laws and policies changed to reflect, as I've said before, the broad national interest.
So are they raising money on the immigration issue? And if so, I mean, what are they doing with the money?
Well, there's two reasons. They basically stir the pot to increase fundraising. As you whip up this fury and this hysteria, and you make it appear as though the immigration debate, which, yes, is very heated, it's a very sensitive issue, but the Southern Poverty Law Center posits this in their quote-unquote intelligence reports and in their donor and fundraising mails, that it's as if the immigration debate is somehow spilling over into the street and causing violence. It is not. Secondly, they have invented, taken out of thin air, this label of hate group, to which they affix to groups they disagree with politically. And then third is they manipulate and they exaggerate data to claim that the immigration debate is increasing hate crime against Latinos. It's not. All of these tactics are really used for fundraising purposes for the SPLC to smear the reputation of groups like FAIR. And it's not about stopping the hate. It's really about shutting down the debate.
So the Southern Poverty Law Center seems to have a lot of friends in the media, and whenever they are quoted, they tend to speak of the group and Morris Dees, who you just mentioned, as people sort of above reproach and with only the highest motives. What is your take on how the media cover them and use them as a source?
Well, unfortunately, if a lie is repeated often enough, it becomes a truth. The initial ad hominem attack is always more potent, has more punch than the pro forma response. And unfortunately, in this age of Googling decades old information, and when everybody and his brother is pretending to be a credible reporter on the internet and on blogs, these myths, these exaggerations keep getting recycled and keep getting more and more extreme. And then they wind up in the mainstream press under the guise of news. Now, you know, I would say to their credit, most responsible journalists, particularly seasoned journalists who have tenure and reputations to be mindful of, most in the media and most people who are knowledgeable about the immigration issue and certainly FAIR's 30-year record of advocating on behalf of the American public have dismissed the smear campaign really for what it is. But, you know, having said that, these attacks against FAIR really distract from the serious debate that needs to take place about this important national issue of immigration.
Before we move on to some other topics, is there anything else you want to say about the pamphlet or the Southern Poverty Law Center, and can you tell people how they might get a copy of it?
Well, I would say this, that I think the most reckless sort of McCarthyistic type of tactic being used to intimidate groups like FAIR and individual Americans who really, you know, look in their local communities and they see damage and cost and degradation and decline in the quality of life and relate that to an immigration system out of control. To use this term hate group, you know, any type of real hate group really does need to be condemned, but there has to be some reasonable definition of what is a hate group and what makes the SPLC's habit so particularly odious is their tendency to take legitimate organizations, calling them hate groups with no criteria, no definition. There's no such thing actually as a hate group in the Department of Justice, and then mixing them in with real hate groups like the KKK to make it appear there's a logical relationship. And if there's no legitimate criteria for your allegation, then it's sort of easy to sort of willy-nilly say the number of hate groups has increased. At one point, this group, the Southern Poverty Law Center, made the ridiculous assertion that 15% of Americans, that's 45 million Americans, belong to hate groups. So it really proves they have no criteria. It's offensive, and frankly, it's an insult to people who are truly are victims of truly dangerous groups.
Now, what is the status there? There's hate crime legislation that is currently part of, I believe it's an amendment to a Senate military appropriations bill or something. What's the status of that, and is that somewhat driven by SPLC?
Well, now, hate crime, now there's no such thing as a hate group. That's just a concoction of the SPLC. Hate crime is a federal statute. It has definitions. And this is another thing that the SPLC does. They contend there is a rise in hate crimes directed at Hispanic. It's basically a mathematical sleight of hand. What they do is they will take a year with the lowest number of victims and then compare it with the highest year to get a dramatic result. You know, anyone can do that, and it gets you a flunking grade in Math 101. They're suggesting hate crimes against Hispanics has gone up, and it's because of the immigration debate, as if the angst over the issue has spilled into the street. The facts say otherwise. Yes, 10 years ago there were 649 Hispanic victims of hate crime. Last year it was 830. That number did go up. But what they failed to do is they failed to factor in this incredible surge of population of Hispanics in that same period. We've gone from 29 million to 45 million. Bottom line is there has been an 18% reduction in crime when properly indexed against Hispanics, and that is very good. Look, Americans are frustrated. They're not frustrated at immigrants. They're angry at politicians who pander to the special interest, who want cheap labor, and the political parties who want instant votes. And they're angry at an immigration policy that really serves a few handful of special interest and not the average American people.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. Just this week, Sheriff Joe Arpaio in Arizona was told by the Office of Homeland Security, led by Janet Napolitano, that he could no longer conduct certain raids to arrest illegal immigrants. What do you think of that story, and what will he do, and what should he do?
Well, Joe Arp, that's the 287G program, and 287G is a partnership between the feds, the federal government, and local law enforcement agents. When you are a local sheriff like Joe Arpaio is, and you have a problem with immigration, which he does in Maricopa County, you can participate in this program called 287G. The feds come in, they train you on proper procedure in order to identify and detain illegal aliens. The fact of the matter is, over the past few years, this has been an extremely successful program, and Sheriff Joe Arpaio, by virtue of the fact that he's probably got one of the worst illegal alien problems in the country, has used that program effectively and has arrested more folks and provided more protections for legal citizens in his community. So the opposition, the special interest, the open borders lobby, the amnesty advocates see Joe Arpaio as kind of the crowning achievement of 287G, and they need to take him out. Look, this administration and Janet Napolitano, who really is she's a pawn for this administration, beholden to special interest. This administration is systematically, methodically, relentlessly reversing, rescinding, and dismantling existing immigration reform programs. E-Verify, 287G, worksite enforcement, defense, to such an extent that, frankly, by the time they get done on doing everything that exists in order to control immigration, there may be no point in having an amnesty bill because they are doing it piecemeal, day by day, and 287G in Maricopa County with Sheriff Joe Arpaio is in the bullseye.
Well, following up on that, what has been the reaction then from the citizens in Arizona, you know, to this intrusion, I'll say, by Homeland Security?
Well, Joe Arpaio, he keeps getting reelected, and in several polls that I've seen recently, he is at an all-time high. He may be one of the most popular sheriffs in America. Why? Because he's using a program that works. He's using it to the letter of the law and not exceeding his authority, and he is providing. Unlike other cities like San Francisco that have sanctuary city policies that basically invite illegal aliens in and look the other way when they take jobs, Joe Arpaio is doing what he was hired to do, and that's to protect the welfare, the safety of his citizens and preserve the vitality of his community. And particularly in this economic downturn when we're all concerned about jobs and wages, it's fundamentally unfair for a local community not to be able to use existing resources in order to dry up the jobs magnet, and that's what he's doing.
If you were to shape our immigration policy, what would it look like?
Well, we'd have more sticks, and we would have less carrots. Basically, we need three things: border enhancements. You reduce the flow at the border. Let's get the fence done. The Secure Fence Act of 2006 said we should have X number of miles of fence. That wasn't an if or a but or maybe or a shall. It said you will build the fence. You dry up the flow at the border. Second, interior enforcement. You make it hard for illegal aliens to work and hard for employers to hire them. E-Verify is a big part of that. Just yesterday, the Senate voted to reauthorize E-Verify only for another 3 years, so it sort of sputters along with a stay of execution. And finally, increased document verification. We need to know who's who. I mean, for all you know, you've got 20 people using your Social Security number right now. If you do all three of those, and you really do them, and not just have press conferences and give lip service, you reduce the incentive to come in the first place. Those solutions are fair, they're practical, they're effective. And they're a lot better than either the mass amnesty option, which is posited on one end of the spectrum, or the mass deportation option, which is posited on the other, which we don't think is tenable.
Well, one of the arguments that we hear, too, about illegal immigration is that they provide cheap labor. Is that not a plus for the economy? What's the deal here?
Well, the fact is that this has been the argument that has been made by big business looking for cheap labor. And the fact is that Americans will do any job provided the working conditions are suitable, adequate, safe, healthy, and that the wages are livable. But when you continue to flood the market with cheap labor that is working under the radar, you prevent Americans from the opportunity to work. You know, this is one of the issues that may be in the category of, from our perspective, good news, and that is that with a downturn in the economy, with increased focus on preservation of jobs and wages, it's going to be difficult for this president to convince the American public that legalizing 12 million illegal aliens who are lowly skilled is a net asset to the economy. Look, Bush couldn't get amnesty passed when we had the illusion of prosperity, stable housing prices, rising stock market. It's really going to be tough for this president, you know, given the continuing recession, a war in Iraq, Afghanistan, a continuing credit crisis, possibly a second mortgage wave, Iran, God knows whatever else is coming down the pike. This is going to be a tough punt for this president to convince the American worker who is struggling and losing his job to buy into a massive amnesty for 12 million illegal aliens.
You mentioned the border fence between the U.S. and Mexico and that it was being built. Give us a status report. How is the Obama administration doing with that? Have they continued building it at the same pace that it was before, and is it enough to reduce the flow?
Well, the fence has hit somewhat of a wall down in Texas. Most of the construction of the fence from California up to Texas has occurred on public land. Now that it's in Texas, it has slowed because much of that is private property, and you've got, I think there are 60, 65 eminent domain lawsuits occurring right now. So there is work to be done. And then there are some environmental concerns, but mostly they are delay tactics by the open borders advocates who are opposed to the construction. Look, the fence is not the be-all and the end-all to fix our immigration crisis. We've got a lot of moving parts to fix, but it is a very tangible statement. It is a visible physical symbol that America recognizes its sovereignty and its right to maintain a rule of law. And where and when the fence has gone up, it has reduced trafficking, smuggling, drug running substantially.
A lot of people noticed during President Obama's speech before Congress about health reform recently that he changed the number of uninsured people from 46 million to 30 million. The difference of 16 million was presumed to be an effort to convince people that he's serious when he says his reform will not include coverage of illegal immigrants. So how do the issues of illegal immigration and health care reform converge?
Well, the claim has been that 47 million Americans are uninsured, but when, as they say, you hear the rest of the story, you see 8.5 million of them are illegal aliens. 12 million are eligible for public programs, never bothered to enroll. 9 million lack insurance for less than a year. I think there's 7.5 million making over $84,000 a year, but for whatever reason, choose not to buy it. Overall, illegal immigrants account for about 18% of the uninsured. Now, if you include legal immigration, illegal immigrants, and the children of legal and illegal immigrants, now you're getting up to about 33% of all of the insured. The bill, as it stands right now, it's in flux. We all know this. The bill doesn't specifically say illegal aliens are covered, but it doesn't close the loopholes that illegal aliens are going to take advantage of to get the benefits, and that's the rub. Basically, there's no enforcement method to ensure compliance. So it's sort of like saying, well, you can't come into my bar if you're under 21 and drink alcohol, but, gee, there's no bouncer at the door to check your IDs. So, there's two parts of this plan. Whether or not there continue to be two parts, we'll see. But you can enroll in a private plan and use affordability credits, which are used to offset the cost. Illegal aliens, if there's no verification, they'll be able to use those vouchers. And the second is the public plan. That's sort of the Medicaid for all system. Illegal aliens are eligible for that, too. Why? Again, because there's no requirement to use any of the verification databases. We've had a little progress over the last few weeks, and right now under consideration is our check is the requirement that Social Security numbers and date of birth be checked. Now, that's conceptual language only. It's not legislative language. We are clearly tracking this, if not hourly, then daily.
We're running out of time. Just a couple more quick points, if you would. Some people would argue that the reason that there's this desire to to give amnesty to the illegal immigrants is that they make a great voter block for the Democrats in particular. Do you see that as part of the motive behind this?
Well, I think the push for amnesty has always come from really three things. I mean, we provided amnesty before. So we've already set a precedent for amnesty, and the folks are lining up at the border expecting another amnesty. And that kind of has a self-propagating perception. Second is, there's no doubt the intense pressure by business to continue to hire cheap labor. There's no question of the continuing pressure by unions, the SEIU, Service Employee International Union, to boost membership. And unfortunately, and I'll have to indict both political parties, both trying to pander to this growing Hispanic base.
Real quick, just tell them where they can find you on the Internet, and we've got to leave it there.
It's my pleasure. Thank you. It's fairus.org, the SPLC guide, the journalist guide to the intimidation tactics of the SPLC is also on that site.
Great. Well, thank you so much for being with us on Take Aim today and for all your important work. And, folks, thank you for being with us for another Take Aim show, and we will be back same time next week. Thank you. Bye-bye.